the scholarly discourse from Research Information.
Welcome to Research Information's Women in Scholarly Communication series, supported by Cactus Communications. This is Tim Gillett. In this edition, I met Mandy Hill, Managing Director of Academic at Cambridge University Press. Hello, Mandy. Thanks very much for joining us. I'd like to start off by talking about your early career and background, if that's all right. Mm-hmm. What originally attracted you to publishing, and how did you get into the industry?
So my sort of entry into publishing was more serendipity rather than planning. I did a degree in biochemistry, didn't have a PhD, wanted to move back towards Oxford, which is where I grew up, and looked for careers that, well, jobs, not even careers at that point, that would use a science degree, didn't need a PhD around Oxford. It was as simple as that. I had no major attraction towards publishing, but obviously 35 plus years later, it's worked out pretty well for me.
Was Oxford University Press your first job?
No. My first job was actually Pergamon Press, okay. which had recently been bought by Elsevier. So the first 6 years of my career were at Elsevier.
So during the early part of your career, were there any particular experiences or roles or people that shaped your approach to leadership that you can recognise now looking back?
I think I've got a good and a bad. I think my first boss taught me the impact of bad management and sort of bad behavior and how it affects team members. And I think that experience was just as meaningful for me in some ways as some of the good experiences I've had. I will say I've been lucky in having more good managers than bad, but I have had a couple of less good ones that have influenced me. But I think one of the things that I look back on my career and think really have shaped me as a leader, I've had a couple of mentors. One, a formal mentor when I was at OUP, in my early days at OUP, and she really helped build my confidence and find my voice as a leader. I think I didn't recognize myself in a leadership role, and she helped me see what I was doing was a form of leadership and sort of build from there.
Thinking about the early years in publishing, was there anything that surprised you about the industry when you started?
The pace of change. When I first started in publishing, and I'm sure people listening to this, some of the people listening to this will be surprised, but we literally had red, green and black pens on our desks. I was a copy editor and proofreader, and we were, if anything came in with a computer disk, a floppy disk, we would throw the disk in the bin because we didn't have computers on our desks. But that changed so quickly, even in those first couple of years that I was working in publishing, and that pace of change has not stopped since. So I think that that's not something, as I say, I went into publishing because it was a job, and I didn't know it was going to turn into this career that was going to evolve so rapidly and keep me engaged and on my toes so much. So I think that's one of the things for me.
So was it that sort of sense of change and challenge that kept you involved in it, or was it something about publishing in itself?
It's both. I mean, if I hadn't grown to love publishing and see the impact in what we do and how important, and genuinely believe and get excited and feel passionate about the importance of academic publishing, I wouldn't still be here and wouldn't be doing the things that I do. But equally, I think because I have a low boredom threshold, if things hadn't changed quickly, I also probably wouldn't still be here. I think it's the combination of both. And you know, I do feel incredibly fortunate to have found a career that's shaped me in other ways. I think it's helped me understand my own values a lot more than I had, you know, as a 20-year-old, I hadn't really considered what my values were. But actually the working in publishing, thinking about the impact of publishing and the kinds of organizations I believe in and want to work for has helped shape my own values as well.
So you went from Pergamon to OUP, and then
Biomedical Communications Agency, which was another story entirely, but a brief interlude.
Okay. So You've now been at Cambridge University Press for 12 years, I believe.
Yeah, indeed.
Having made the move from Oxford, the other place. For those outside the organisation, how would you describe your role as the Managing Director of Academic Publishing?
My answer to that question probably partly depends on the day you ask me, but I think it's, in theory, it's looking at the big picture, thinking about where do we need to go, how do we need to get there. So with that big picture might be everything from what do we want to be doing more of, how do we really build on the reputation of Cambridge, you know, what are we doing in open access, which bits of our portfolio should we grow, all of those questions, you know, thinking about what the role of a university press is today and how we add more value, what are we doing with AI. So that big picture and sort of strategy. Then we've got the budget piece. There's always money that we need to be thinking about. And so a lot of what I do is thinking about budgets. And of course, none of that works without people being in the right place and having the right skills and sort of being emotionally engaged. So, you know, so much of what I do is thinking about the people side of the business as well. That balance between that strategy, budget and people, I think sort of shifts all of the time and it's hard to get right. But I would say that those are the sort of the three big components of my role.
Yeah. So is there such a thing as a typical day or a typical week or a typical month?
No. One of the things that for me personally I like about the job is no 2 days really look the same, and that variety. So yeah, it there's going to be a real mix of budget meetings, strategy meetings, board meetings, making decisions and looking at what's stopping us doing the things we need to do or how we can accelerate things, catching up with various people, looking at technology developments, understanding what's happening in the market, writing my blogs, communicating. So it's a real mix. Yeah. And every day and every week varies.
Yeah. So what do you find are the most rewarding aspects of the job? And conversely, what are the most difficult things you have to do?
So I think anyone who knows me personally will know I'm quite a competitive person. So I think wherever we do well, it's something that motivates me personally, and I like seeing, you know, I'm a planner, so I like seeing plans worked out and come to fruition. So that's kind of on the sort of the organization side of things. But I think in my role now, probably the thing that is most rewarding for me is actually seeing the pride that everybody else within the organization feels, and because I do less, you know, in terms of actually getting my hands dirty. Yeah. It's more that the pride and the joy that you see other people having when we've achieved something. And I think you know, when we win a prize for some of our books, for example, or journals get, you know, fantastic coverage, we win a new contract, all of those things, you get that real buzz across the teams, and I think that's probably the thing that lifts me all of the time. In terms of what's most challenging, I mean, unfortunately, in a business of this scale and nature, sometimes we have to make tough people choices. So by that, I mean, sadly, when you're doing an organizational redesign, sometimes people lose their jobs. And, you know, I've said to people a few times, the day that stops being tough is the day that you shouldn't be doing a job like this, because it should be tough to make a decision that affects somebody's job. So yeah, those will always be the toughest decisions I have to make.
I guess it is always going to be tough, but in some ways you have to disregard that because you're making it as a pure business decision, and that's it.
Again, people will have heard me say this before. I believe in making the decision with your business brain on and then implementing it with your people brain on. Because you have to make the right decision for the business. That is the job. But you've got to be empathetic to the reality of people's lives as you think about how you implement it. And I recognize it won't always feel like that to the people on the receiving end of these decisions. But that's how we try to think about things.
Yeah, good. So Cambridge is goes back a fair way.
And it, 500 years
in 2034. And it's got an enviable heritage and reputation. Is it easy to balance that legacy and tradition while pushing the business forward and continuing to innovate?
Yes, I think those two things are completely consistent. You know, we wouldn't be nearly 500 years old if we had been a static business, always doing things in the same way. We would have gone out of business and disappeared a long time ago. So I think we've shown over the decades and centuries our ability to continue to meet changing needs. I think that what's always grounded us and will continue to ground us is our commitment to the mission. And so thinking about using that as the North Star, the decision-making focus, actually helps you think about, well, how should we be innovating? What are the needs of the researchers? We're not here to make money. We're here to deliver for researchers and for students. What do they need today? That's what we're here for. That's what the mission's about. Yeah. So I think actually that reputation and mission helps drive that innovation as well.
And looking forward a little bit, what are there any particularly exciting opportunities that you see for the press in the next 5-10 years?
I think if you'd said to me 5 years ago, is this an exciting period? I'd have said, yes, this is the most exciting period. There's lots happening. I now look ahead at the next 5 years and think, this is the most exciting period. There's going to be lots happening. But it genuinely feels that the impact of AI on our users and how they interact with our content is going to be so much more significant. And the pace of change, as I said before, is just picking up even further. And I know that for some that can feel a little bit scary. I think it's also a massive opportunity for us. And I think for us as a university press to be a voice thinking about what are the needs of the researchers? How do we secure their best interests through all of this period of change? What is the value that we can add? I think so. For us to be a voice through this period of change that's sort of helping really drive good outcomes for researchers feels exciting. It can feel a bit exhausting, but I think it's what we're here for.
Indeed. Yeah, I remember the first time we met, I think it was 11 years ago in Frankfurt, we interviewed you and we didn't mention artificial intelligence.
No.
incredible, really. So this series of interviews is called Women in Scholarly Communications. How do you think the industry has changed during your career in terms of opportunities for women?
I think, you know, there's clearly, and this isn't just about publishing, I think this is about the workplace generally, there's less overt sexism and sexual harassment than there was when I started my career. Whilst publishing has always been female dominated, the top jobs when I started were always held by men. And that is not the case anymore. And I think that's great. I remember the time when I walked into an editorial board meeting for the first time, and all of the editorial board members were men, and they looked at me and said, tea has arrived, because they assumed that I was there to serve the tea. You wouldn't have that experience today. You know, the expectation that a woman is only there, and probably at the time they'd have described me as a girl, is only there to serve in some way. So I think we've shifted a long way. We haven't gone as far as we need to. We've still obviously got gender pay gaps, because we have a higher percentage of men in senior jobs still than we do women. There's a lot more to do. And unfortunately, I do still hear from my team about sexual harassment that does occur. It's much less than it was, but we need to eradicate that completely. And, I'm sure we could have a whole separate conversation about that. I think, though, I recognise that having said all those negatives, I have always been in a lucky position that I have had strong female leaders around me that I have been able to look up to and who have supported my career development. So I've you know, like most women of my age, I've had some bad experiences and some difficult experiences, but I've also been lucky to have far more good experience and support.
Does something like the tea incident hold you back, or does it have the converse effect where it drives you on and forwards? And
yeah, I think at the time, it took me years to get over that in my relationship with that board. I always felt undermined by that board, yeah, because they always saw me as lesser. And maybe that was a chip on my shoulder rather than what they actually felt, but that was how I felt. And I do think that was partly informed by some of those early interactions. But I am stubborn. And so probably in part because of that, it kicked me on to think, that's not going to hold me back. So it's probably a little bit of both.
Yeah.
It affected me in that relationship, but actually also spurred me on.
Yeah. You mentioned that the other women helped you on the journey. Any that you particularly want to highlight?
My first boss at OUP, Janet Boleyn, she was such a wonderful person, because she was probably the first, she was the editorial director for journals, and she was the first senior leader I had seen as a woman who was so, I don't know a better word for this, feminine. She wasn't macho. She wasn't trying to be sort of masculine in a board environment or putting on sort of a hard-nosed edge. She showed that you could be really effective, really strong-willed, and deliver great results, but still retain her identity as a woman.
So
many people I know will describe Janet as a real lady. And she genuinely was, but you knew when she wanted something and she got it. And I think that was something that really stuck with me and influenced me in thinking that you don't need to try to be something you're not.
In terms of influence, would you give any advice to women who are starting out in their careers in publishing or scholarly comms to influence them and the way they carry themselves and deal with things like that?
I think that message of not trying to be something you're not is important. And obviously we've all got things we need to refine and some aspects of your characteristics you want to develop and some that you want to sort of minimize. But I think not trying to be something you're not, it is really important for us. So, you know, if you're a really empathetic, good listener, using that as a strength and not thinking that you need to be always hard-nosed, I think, you know, and recognizing that within yourself and how to use that as a leader, I think is really, really important.
Yeah, good. So if we can turn to the wider industry now, scholarly communications is undergoing big changes. It's always undergoing big changes, it seems, but particularly so at the moment with AI and open research and business models that shift and change every year. What do you think is going to have the biggest long-term impact in terms of what's going on at the moment?
Yeah, and we touched on this earlier. I think AI is fundamentally going to change how our users engage with our content, and therefore, you know, has the potential to radically shift the role of publishers. I think it's going to be a huge impact on what we do and how we do it, in a way that's more fundamental than anything we've seen before.
And does that excite you, or does it fill you with dread?
To be honest, probably a little bit of both. I think change is a good thing, and we all recognise that you know change is necessary. And as I say, I like change, but I think it's really difficult to see exactly where this is going to go and what the right answers are. So I think it can feel a little bit daunting. I think it's a time when bringing in diversity of voices and recognizing the answers aren't all going to come from 57-year-old women or 57-year-old leaders. You know, it's we're going to need to bring in different voices, different generations, different perspectives to help us find the answer through. So I think it's it's another one of those situations where, you know, if you, it could feel a little bit daunting, but actually to use that as a spur to do things differently and to think more creatively and to push on, I think, and to genuinely go back to what is academic publishing here for? We're here to support the impact of research and to think, how do we do that? And not clinging on to the old models, but just thinking, really going back to the basics and remembering why we're here. And I think that it comes back to your question about sort of what the role of Cambridge and how, you know, yeah, an old organisation can change. I think if you think about the mission, we'll be all right.
Research Information as a publication kind of sits in the middle of a kind of triangular relationship, if you like, between publishers, researchers and librarians, mm-hmm, which on the face of it, see that relationship has been pretty set in stone for quite a long time. Do you think that is going to change?
Yes, and I speak quite a lot to Dr. Jess Gardiner, who, the university librarian at Cambridge, a wonderful leader herself, and has just driven a lot of change and really thought-provoking. But I can see that, you know, in my conversations with her, it's clear that the role of the librarian is changing, the role of the library is changing as well, and AI is changing how researchers work. You know, we're talking to researchers all of the time, and that they're saying that they can see how just their very day-to-day work is being changed by the tools that are available to them now. So all of us are experiencing this pace of change and the impact on our work, and that's bound to mean that our relationships change. And this is why I think open conversation and us being collaborative and thinking about what are we trying to achieve here and not being adversarial is really important.
You mentioned there that you frequently talk to the Cambridge Library, and obviously you are part of a university. Yeah. Does that give Cambridge and other university presses, I guess, a different responsibility compared to the commercial side of the business? Or I know you are commercial, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, I think so. And I know, you know, I've spoken, obviously I've worked for a commercial publisher, and I have a lot of respect for counterparts at commercial publishers who I think do some amazing work and create great products and services. But fundamentally, their mission, all their measures of success are financial. How they get there is through the academic publishing, but they're measured by their financial success. We are measured by the success of delivery of the university's mission. And so I do think that connection with the academic community is in our bones in a way that's different. So yes, I think it does give us a responsibility to support researchers through all of this change that comes back to, I actually think that's quite exciting or motivating. Yeah, motivating is probably the right word.
This isn't on my list of questions, but do you think there's anything that university presses can teach the commercial publishers?
I don't know about
that. Yeah, answer that if you
don't. Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't, because we're just different. You know, as I say, I think they do lots of things brilliantly and can do some things that we can't. You know, some of the big commercial publishers have resources that we would just dream of. So I just think it's accepting it and respecting the fact that we have quite a few things in common, but we also have quite a few things that are different. Those can both have a place in the ecosystem.
Is there anything that you'd like to see happen across the wider scholarly communications industry that you feel isn't moving fast enough or isn't happening quickly enough?
Yeah, I think in answer to this question, I think I'm going to think mainly around the open access shift on, particularly on the journal side of the industry. I think it's quite clear that you're familiar with our Publishing Futures report from last year, you know, it's quite clear that researchers are still being incentivized to publish too much and in too traditional and rigid formats. So it's all about journal articles and as many journal articles as possible. And that is not really healthy or useful or supporting research impact and using all the tools that are available, and it's not financially sustainable. I think everyone gets that, but not enough is actually happening to change it. And so, you know, I'm hopeful and we're having good conversations, but I think really people stepping up to the plate and being prepared to start to make some changes. And it's tough though, because it's connected.
Where do you think the impetus is going to come from to make it happen then?
Let me come back to you on that one when we have some answers. I think because it is so hard. Some of these things are so ingrained that it's going. It is hard. But I think what we can't have is everybody waiting for somebody else to make the change.
On to a few personal reflections, if that's okay. What achievement are you personally most proud of?
I find that one quite a tricky one.
You're too modest.
No, it's very difficult. Yeah, so as you say, I've been in my job now for 12 years. And in this role, most of what Cambridge achieves, somebody else has actually done. So I think it's largely about teamwork and thinking about maybe the answer is around how I try to create an environment where other people can do great things. And I can look at some things that Cambridge has achieved, and I like to think I've helped and supported and influenced that in various ways. One thing that I can say I genuinely instigated and really feel very proud of, and is really relevant for us at Cambridge, is the work that I kicked off a few years ago with colleagues at the university that led to Cambridge Online Education and the online courses that we've launched, and the working with Jess Gardner. I think that relationship with the university across online courses and at the university library, that is in a very different place than it was a few years ago. And that's partly because of the changes within the university and what they need and what their needs, etc. But I think I feel that that's been something that I've personally invested quite a lot of time and effort in, and I can see that that is yielding impact. So yeah, I guess that would be one thing I could point to.
Good to hear it. What do you wish that more people understood about scholarly publishing?
I mean, going back to your very first question about when I went into academic publishing, I had no idea what it was. No idea at all. You know, as a new graduate, I did not know what academic publishing was. I don't think my parents ever understood my job. And so I think if I could get more people to understand that we are an integral part of the research process. Research is only as good as the other people who know about it. And that's what we enable. And, you know, whether it's COVID-19 or understanding the mistakes of history, all of those things are important for our society, and it only has impact through publishing. Yeah, so I think people recognizing that we're a genuine value add in that process, that feels to me that, you know, there are too many people, even relatively close within academia, who perhaps see us as a cost rather than a value.
Yeah. I was telling a friend last week about what I did, and he kind of went, "Oh, that's a bit niche, isn't it?" Yeah. I said, "Well, not really, no. it's quite a big industry."
Yeah. How many researchers are there in the world?
Yeah, yeah.
How many universities are there?
Indeed.
And we support them.
If you weren't in scholarly communications, if you hadn't taken that step all those years ago, what do you think you'd be up to now?
Yeah, as I say, I did biochemistry at university, so I enjoyed sciences. I've always enjoyed the sciences, and I think if I hadn't gone down this path, I might have done something that was a bit more clinically aligned. I wasn't going to become a doctor. I knew that I think I would have been a terrible doctor, but I might have done something that was aligned in some way. So maybe forensics or physiotherapy or something like that. Something that would have tapped into my sciences. But if I was to change, and then the other career that I thought about for a number of years was actually catering, because I also love to cook. And when I was choosing my A-levels, I really wanted to do home economics, as it was called then, but yeah, my science teachers persuaded me not to. So yeah, but either one of those directions probably was what I would have gone for.
It doesn't sound like you've got any regrets.
No, I'm not a regrets kind of person.
No, good. You probably almost just answered my next question. What do you do to switch off after work?
I haven't actually answered the question because I'm now gardening. I mean, I still love to cook, but I'm very fortunate. I have a husband who also loves to cook. So he does most of the cooking during the week and we cook together at the weekend. But I really love to garden, and that being outside, physical nature of gardening, benefits of fresh air, and seeing the impact of what you're doing, that's a big and important part of my life.
Good stuff. So just a couple more questions, then we're finished. What gives you the greatest optimism about the future of research and scholarly communication?
I think it's, and this might sound a little bit naff, but this industry is full of absolutely brilliant people who care passionately about what we do. And it's quite clear to me that with that drive and commitment, and with the intellects that they all bring, we're going to find ways through the challenge, any challenges that come our way. It doesn't matter which department, which publisher you go into, you will find amazing people with amazing ideas and energy, and that I think that gives that's got to drive optimism.
And lastly, looking to the generation behind you, I guess, the ones that are now entering the industry, is there a overarching message that you'd like to leave for them?
I guess buckle up for the ride. it's going to take you to some unexpected places, perhaps. It's going to stretch you, but I think it's going to be an incredibly rewarding career. But you've just not got to think you know where it's going to go exactly.
That's a great note to finish on. Mandy, thanks so much for your time. For your insight and your wisdom. it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank
you.
Good
to see you again.
Thank you.
The Scholarly Discourse, from Research Information.